They've imposed vaccinations. AT&T, Boeing, a number of major companies, large companies in the Fortune 500 have gone ahead on their own and required vaccinations.
From Stanford University and SiriusXM, this is Stanford Legal. I'm Rich Ford.
And I'm Joe Bankman. And today we're talking with our colleague, William Gould, about vaccine mandates, the Great Resignation, and whether the Supreme Court is about to change how we think about a healthy workplace. Well, Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Joe.
We know you've got a new book. It actually has the word pandemic in it. And this show has been focusing on the pandemic for what it seems to be years now, and I think is years. And we had two Supreme Court cases heard last week. One of the cases has gotten most of the attention. They involve your area. Can you tell us a little bit about the case that's gotten the attention? I think it's called National Federation of Independent Business First Department of Labor.
Yes. This case arises out of the so-called Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, enacted by Congress to assure safe and healthful working conditions for the nation's workforce and to preserve the nation's human resources. It's been on the books now for 52 years. It gives the authority to the Secretary of Labor to promulgate standards and to, in some circumstances, to fashion so-called emergency temporary standards. Those are what have been employed in this case to address some of the problems that have emerged from the pandemic. Secretary has proposed standards which would require employers who employ 100 or more workers to either vaccinate the unvaccinated, or with regard to those who remain unvaccinated, to insist upon protective gear in the form of masks and to provide for regular testing for those workers. This is not the first time that OSHA has ventured into this realm. It has really undertaken three major initiatives. One is at the time of the HIV crisis, it provided for regulated so-called blood pathogens with regard to HIV and to hepatitis B and hepatitis C. It has also provided rules which have imposed requirements for employers to allow workers to have their own drinking cups or drinking facilities so that they don't share with one another and don't promote the possibility of infectious disease. That was done in construction. And they've also, in the area of agriculture, devised rules which are designed to protect workers against dust and heat. What these rules all have in common with one another, including the one that is being employed now by the department, is that they deal with problems of infectious diseases, and they deal with problems that arise both out of the workplace and in the workplace. I mentioned that at the outset because much of the discussion and the oral argument, much of the attention was, and by the Trump administration, which preceded the Biden administration, was focused upon what is unique to the workplace, saying that OSHA only had jurisdiction in that area.
So this looks like the kind of thing that OSHA typically does, just keeping the workforce safe, But other people seem to think, wow, it's overreach because they're delving into medicine and public health. Do you think that OSHA has the authority to issue this kind of mandate?
I think that OSHA has the authority to do it. This is the first time, however, that OSHA has been ever presented with a problem quite like this. This is the first time the country has been provided with, has encountered a problem like this in a century, at least a century. And this may be in some respects far more formidable, although we have more weapons to fight this disease than we had a century ago. A wide variety of arguments have been put forward to say that OSHA does not have the authority. One of them, Chief Justice Roberts, noted in oral argument that, this problem didn't exist in 1970 when the statute was passed. Well, of course, we know that, my goodness, all kinds of problems didn't exist at the time when the statutes are passed. That's why we have to have agencies and courts and lawyers and law professors that we have new problems that pose new challenges to statutory interpretation. Other arguments, which perhaps we can go into.
You know, Bill, I think they're confused here because we're used to the authorities doing all sorts of things to restrict our freedom with the pandemic. Most of us like those restrictions. Some of us chafe against them. So the county can say, I can't really leave my home, shelter in place. The state can say things. School districts can say things. One of the things I think for our kind of lay audience is there's a difference between the state saying this, I take it, and the federal government saying this.
So that's one of the first things that Chief Justice Roberts in particular mentioned at the beginning of the oral argument. He said, this is really within the police power of the states. And the Supreme Court, as early as 1905, upheld Massachusetts's authority to vaccinate over objectors there. But they didn't say anything about precluding the federal government. And of course, this is a clearly something that affects the entire nation. The other point that's made that's closely related one is that a number of the justices is that Congress should have spoken explicitly. Well, Congress, when we deal with employment statutes, isn't always in a position to speak explicitly. The question is largely one of who has the expertise? In what manner did Congress intend to have this responsibility discharged? And in fact, in connection with HIV, Congress not only explicitly authorized OSHA's involvement in infectious diseases, but expressed dissatisfaction with OSHA's tardiness in fashioning rules and urged it to gave it a deadline. And it said, if you don't meet this deadline, we're going to, by law, impose the proposed rule. So it's quite the contrary to what a number of the Supreme Court justices seem to be articulating, the position they seem to be articulating in this oral argument. This is not something that is new, although it is an unprecedented challenge.
So there are a set of arguments about potential overreach on the part of OSHA, but I imagine that the businesses have some more specific reasons for wanting to resist this. What are some of their, real objections to this? Why don't they want to do it?
As manifested in their arguments, I think it takes a number of different forms. One is what they call these days, whataboutism. Justice Gorsuch said during the oral argument, the Supreme Court has issued a revised transcript this morning. He claims he was misquoted, saying that the flu is a major problem. And that he said He said, according to the transcript, he said hundreds of thousands of people are die because of the flu. In fact, 30,000, somewhere between 12 and 50,000, generally recently 30,000 per year die because of the flu, whereas we know this virus has killed 850,000 people, and it is enormous. Now, of course, Gorsuch received a great deal of criticism. He claimed that he really said hundreds, comma, thousands of workers. But there is, if you look at the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which was the first circuit to have a bite at this, they tended to downplay this. They said that this is something that really isn't out of the ordinary. The emergency rule requirement says that the threat must be grave, and that that the rule that you're proposing must be necessary. And the Fifth Circuit's line, and Justice Gorsuch's questioning on Friday, seemed to be, well, this is not something that's all that unusual. Why don't you regulate XYZ as well? That's part of it. Another part of it, of course, is they argue that why did you pick 100 employees? This is an arbitrary figure. And OSHA said, look, well, Congress has picked numbers of workers under Title VII, under the Family Leave Act of the 1990s, 1992, Medical Leave Act. We had to go somewhere. They've said that, well, you're not really, you're comparing apples to oranges. There are a lot of these workers who are unvaccinated, who are less likely to die than the people who are vaccinated. Look at the over 65 who are vaccinated, as opposed to some of these young people between 18 and 24 that are unvaccinated. You should have done it on the basis of age, failing to take into account, of course, the fact that all these people, no matter what threat the disease poses to their health, could carry this virus and transmit it to others.
Bill, just to follow up on Rich, what is the real position of labor and big business here? I imagine a lot of big companies kind of like this rule because it gives them authority to do what they want to do anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Hormel has negotiated a collective bargaining agreement with the United Food and Commercial Workers, where they have fashioned an imposition of vaccination. This of course, doesn't do that. This rule doesn't do that. It allows an alternative. They've imposed vaccinations. AT&T, Boeing, a number of major companies, large companies in the Fortune 500, have gone ahead on their own and required vaccinations. The Houston Medical Hospital people, where the first round of litigation took place, where they said, look, you've got to get vaccinated or you can't be employed here anymore. They were exhibit number one in the oral argument because very few people left the employer and resigned because of the possibility, because of the requirement of vaccination.
So is that one of the things that the businesses who are opposed to this are claiming that they're worried about, that if they have to require people to be vaccinated, they're going to lose their employees?
Oh, yes. Yes. That looms large in the at least in the appendices, the exhibits that have been filed in these cases. We're not going to be able to function effectively. We're going to lose our workers, that looms large. Now you don't hear really. I don't think many of the big companies filed amici. Their position isn't well represented in those who challenge this rule. The position of states that are hostile to President Biden. Many of them filed a brief, some of them who aren't. About half the states of the union signed on to a brief challenging this rule, the attorney generals.
We'll be back with more from Bill Gould next on Sirius XM Business Radio, Channel 132.
Welcome back to Stanford Legal, where we look at the cases, questions, conflicts, and legal stories that affect us all every day. I'm Rich Ford, and I'm here with my colleague, Bill Gould, who's an expert on labor law, and who's talking to us about the issues around COVID-19 vaccine mandates and labor issues more generally. And Bill, when you mentioned that one of the reasons the employers were so worried about the vaccine mandate is that they were afraid of losing workers. And that kind of fits into a bigger trend going on post-COVID, doesn't it? With respect to what people are calling the great resignation, where people are leaving their jobs in large numbers. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that the great resignation, so to speak, as it's come to be called, does fit into this. Workers are increasingly dissatisfied, increasingly hesitant to take up particular kinds of work. And this hesitancy has been expressed on behalf of and by so-called essential workers, workers who have been involved on the front lines of the pandemic. Here we're speaking of workers who work in medical facilities, for instance, and the other case that it was the companion case with the one that we've been discussing involved the government's authority to require vaccination amongst employees in medical facilities who have contact with patients. There is a great deal of activity by such workers, by grocery employees who have a lot of contact with the public, other and employees who perform work that is in the nature of first protectors, police and fire. And among some of these workers, they have been traditionally unorganized, unrepresented, more vulnerable, not only in terms of their exposure to the virus, but also more vulnerable in the workplace generally. They are the so-called marginalized workers who have had very little union representation. And we see now the unions attempting in some measure to either organize such workers or to represent them more effectively, particularly here in California, where the food and commercial workers, for instance, has espoused a legislation which it provides for various protections for workers in grocery and supermarkets.
You know, it's almost, Bill, like the workers are saying, we're just not going to take this anymore. And often we're familiar with unionized workers doing that. But here it seems like workers really across the spectrum, if they're low paid or in some cases not so low paid, are saying, you know, we're not getting enough of the spoils, really. And it's just not worth it for us to show up, to continue this job. Let's rethink the labor force.
Yes, I think that I think that's true. I think that of course, it's been more possible in this particular moment to find alternate employment. And sometimes even when it isn't, the workers are saying, I'd rather rely upon the savings and I have or on my spouse or partner's income to tide me over in this interim period. There is a general shifting How long it will last, we don't know. But a shift in power towards workers from capital.
Fascinating. It's almost as if it's a kind of a disorganized labor protest. And so it's workers aren't unionized, but nevertheless, they're pushing back. And do you think that this is mainly due to fear of getting COVID, or is it more that COVID has changed people's perspective? And it's kind of like, life is too short for me to put up with this lousy job.
Well, I think it's primarily to do with two things. One is the fear of the virus. And the other is the possibility of alternate employment, given the general shortage of labor. I walked into an establishment here in Palo Alto the other day that said, we have to shut down in the middle of the day because we don't have employees who can keep this place open. You're seeing that kind of thing. And so I think it's a combination of those two factors. And the big unanswered question is whether unions will be able to move in. They have been in a period of substantial decline for years, had a little bit of a bump back in the past year, whether they'll be able to gain some measure of revival from this new phenomenon.
You know, it's almost as if the shortage of labor itself is something that, like, a strong unionized force would be able to kind of threaten management with. And now, in a disorganized way, labor's achieved that same result. It's more people realize how valuable labor is as soon as you don't have it. And yes, Bill, one of the things that we're going to be looking for is what the Supreme Court is going to do on this wing of what's going on. That is it going to enforce the mandates? You heard the cases. If it enforces the mandates, maybe some labor leaves. So it's kind of all tied together. Before we close, I want to get your guess as to how did the argument go? Who do you think is going to win on the case we discussed?
I think it's likely that the employers win this case. I think a majority of the justices, this new conservative majority, were for the most part very much impressed with the arguments that the employers made. I think it's a 6-3 vote. I would hedge my bet a little bit because I would have thought that the oral argument was so one-sided that the decision would have been issued by now involving a stay. Today, January 10th, is the day that the employers are required to begin to look to see who in their workforce is vaccinated and who is unvaccinated. And what are they, to come up with plans which would become operative on February 9th. The court hasn't issued a ruling yet. And it may be that there are some of the conservative majority who are hesitant themselves because, quite frankly, it deprives the president of the one modest initiative that he's been able to make on a nationwide basis beyond speeches. And it may not be politically wise for them. This could be an example of Mr. Dooley and the attitude of the Supreme Court and the public. This is an issue that the public understands, I think, very well, and may not forget.
Wow. And in the time we have left, I wonder what you think about the broader implications. So there are these political implications. What about the implications for labor law generally if the Supreme Court decides that that OSHA can't do this?
Yes, I think this fits into a pattern that this Supreme Court has displayed in connection with handling a wide variety of labor cases. Two areas come to mind in particular. One was the case where the Supreme Court came up with this new idea of compelled speech and saying that workers who are required to pay unions dues three years ago in the Janus decision were being unconstitutionally deprived of their speech, their ability to and being compelled to speak the way the union wanted them to speak. A new concept entirely, one that had never been heard of outside of a few religious cases. And the second is the Federal Arbitration Act of 1925, which really the Supreme Court has used to deprive workers of the ability to use most employment law cases, discrimination, wrongful discharge, many others, even though the federal Congress in 1925, when it enacted the statute, never focused one iota upon employment laws. They weren't there. They weren't existent. They're able to find that in federal arbitration, but are able to search for an intent in connection with this rule, which they say is lacking.
Well, we've got to wrap up this show, but what's clear to me, and I think Rich too, is the whole movement of labor law in the Supreme Court and in society is entering a new phase. And we welcome you back, Bill, as this new phase unfolds, starting with the decision which we'll hear maybe any day now. Thank you
very much, Joe.
Thank you,
Rich. Thank you.